Good afternoon, everybody. Hi there. I think it's exactly 4:30, so it's time to get going. And thanks very much to all of you for taking the time and coming along to the first sessional meeting hosted by what is the Market Conduct Committee. It used to be the Treating Customers Fairly Committee until a couple of years ago, or just under 2 years ago. We've got three members of the committee here today. It's myself, Tamar, and Peter will be taking part at various stages during the presentation. The agenda for this afternoon, we thought first of all we'd talk a bit about ourselves, the committee, the background to it, why we're here, what our remit is, take you through a summary of the terms of reference for the committee and our objectives and the scope, and then just tie that in quickly to why that would matter for actuaries, why the profession would be interested to have a committee such as this. Then really the meat of the presentation, we thought that having discussed what market conduct is and why the society felt the need to put this committee together, we then look at some examples of market conduct issues that we have discussed and that I think when you see the issues that we raise, I'm sure they're things that quite a lot of you will have come across over the years. And what we'd like to do with that is maybe have a bit of a panel discussion with some questions, but really our preference, our strong preference would be to get input from you guys who've come along, because I think that'll help us certainly to hear what people in the profession are saying, but I think also the diversity of opinion that we'll get will hopefully add a lot to the quality of the debate. So if you are going to speak at any stage, we have roving microphones. The session is being recorded. So if you want to ask a question, I'm going to have to ask you please to wait to have a microphone, and then your words, whatever you're saying, will be recorded for posterity there. That's not to scare you away. It's just to let you know that we do need the mics to be out there if we do have any questions or discussion. So moving in, if we just look at the scope of the committee, it's fairly straightforward, is to look at matters relating to market conduct, but obviously in the context of members of ASSA. So that's fairly straightforward. So when you get together and you start looking at something like this, the obvious question to come up with is, well, what then is market conduct? How would that arise and where would it fit? So we did some research and we came up with a definition, and this is the definition we came up with. And I think the key points here, this is about, there's some important words on that slide. So it's about entities, which I suppose is a code word for the companies that we work for. And it's the behavior of those companies in some, just a few key areas. All to do with product, and it's to do with the design, the pricing, and the distribution of products. So a market conduct issue would be, for example, if you want to look at the promotion strategy for a product, you know, if you bundle a product into another product, then that would be a promotion strategy that you would be adopting. Credit Life would be a good example of that. We'll be talking a bit more about that, or maybe a lot more about that later on. But if, for example, you sold credit in a way that it was implied that without buying insurance you wouldn't get the credit, then you can see a promotion strategy there, which would be a behavior of the entity that was doing that. So design issues, pricing issues, and promotion strategy issues. This links back to treating customers fairly. I mean, this committee was started some years ago as the Treating Customers Fairly Committee. I think that was back when the FSB was getting going on the Treating Customers Fairly track. I mean, we know TCF was always an FSB initiative from the early days. ASSA saw the need to put a body together to oversee the interaction of the TCF principles with the profession. I think market conduct itself is a broader remit, and that's where we came from. That's why we've now been reshaped. The six TCF principles, though, I think still underpin a lot of the work of the committee and are important for the profession. So we thought we'd quickly put those up and just run through them again. I mean, I'm sure I should have said one by one, shout them out. Let's see who knows these. That would have been an interesting test. But yeah, TCF principles deal with, as you can see these things here, the culture of the companies that we work for. You're supposed to have a culture of treating customers fairly within your businesses. The target market for your products is supposed to be appropriate. So selling 25-year annuities, or sorry, 25-year endowments in an old age home would be a good example of not quite meeting that. If there's things that your customers need to know during any part of the currency of the product, so whether it's at the purchase stage, the claim stage, or any point in between, you're supposed to be communicating with them about what they need to know. Advice should obviously be suitable for customers, and I guess, you know, I do a lot of work making presentations to members of the public or members of pension funds and so on. And I must say, this is one of the biggest bugbears that seems to come up a lot if we're listening to what the public is telling us. So whenever you talk about the getting or giving of good advice, you always get a good laugh when you say, get yourself a trustworthy financial planner. And people have got a great and very healthy skepticism for the quality of the advice they're getting out there. But the TCF principle turns that around and puts the responsibility back on the firms, on the companies that we work for and play such an important role in. Obviously, the promises made during the selling process and inherent in the product have got to be delivered, or should be delivered, in line with whatever the customer would have expected from that process. And then the no unreasonable post-sale barriers just refers to the rights that people would have at any point during the operation of a product to make new decisions, such as stopping the product, changing it, adding to it, whatever. So post-sale barriers come out there. So those were the TCF principles. And I think if you think back to the definition of market conduct, you know, the design, the pricing, the promotion of products, you can see these are all very, very much tied up in here and all talking to the same thing, really. The committee in being formed, part of the terms of reference of the committee is that we will draw members from all practice areas, and I think we've pretty much done that. It's quite a big committee for that reason. I mean, we all know that the practice areas that actuaries work in have grown over the years. I think the one gap at the moment is someone from the investment side, but if actually contact has been made with us by the investment committee, and we're looking to put that right pretty soon. So the idea here is that by having somebody from each practice area, of course, then as issues are raised, we hope to be able to home in on and get action in that area. The objectives of the committee, I've just got a few slides on that, and I apologize in advance for these slides. I hate slides like this. It's just a cut and paste. It's a verbatim what the terms of reference said, but we couldn't really find a better way of doing it, so this is what it is. So supporting the development and thought leadership of the profession in the context of market conduct. And the means for doing that really is the development either of formal, you know, protocols through the SAP or APN structures, or preparing and presenting CPD events. And today is the first such one that we've done of those. And of course, this is a professionalism CPD event, so we can all claim, those of you still claiming hours, can hopefully get a healthy hour and a half jump start to your year. We want to contribute, or we're expected to contribute, to the strategic direction of the society with regard to market conduct and support the brand of the profession. I think that's very important. Also to support the regulatory authorities. So obviously we're trying to, or we would like to have influence over, be able to comment on and give input to the regulatory authorities. And in fact, in this regard, the committee has a seat on a body called the Market Conduct Regulatory Framework Steering Committee. It's a bit of a mouthful, but that's a body that sits and meets in the offices of the FSB once a quarter. And it's an amalgamation or coming together of a vast array of industry bodies, regulatory bodies, lobby groups, whatever. But through that, we're getting up to speed with what's going on in the regulatory environment and have the opportunity, therefore, to make input to what's going on there and comment on what's happening. Whether they listen to what we say is another question, of course. The key responsibilities, now you'll see, flow from the objective. So there's a kind of a big overlap here. Obviously, we're trying to monitor developments from the perspective of the profession. And this links directly back then to having all the practice areas represented on the committee, because then we hope that whatever we identify or is passed through to us, we'll be able to deal with. Obviously, developing and reviewing and adapting SAPs and APNs. And then a couple of very important interactions, one with the practice area committees themselves and the other with the Professional Matters Board where appropriate. So part of the committee's output is then to talk to the other key areas within the professional body. Identifying CPD needs and opportunities, obviously. And then critically, I think the risks to the profession. If we see something that we think is a threat to the profession or a big risk for the profession, we need to talk to council and then try and help them develop strategies to deal with those. If needs be, making input to public policy submissions, talking to council generally on market conduct issues, and supporting and making recommendations to the regulatory authorities. So you can see these all tie in with the objectives, and you can see the thread running through there, hopefully. Communicating on a regular basis with members, and that we'll do in various ways, which we're still talking about doing. Then something we haven't really spent much time on yet is forging links with the international body or bodies and seeing how we can interact with them and hopefully learn from them what's going on in other parts of the world, how they're tackling problems, regulatory issues, and so on. And then the other way around, making input backwards into those bodies. So if I might say, I think, you know, we've had people talk to us, we get input from members, and we've had input from members already, and the committee members coming through. But if I had to kind of like try and just encapsulate this thing, the Market Conduct Committee, I had to get my mind around this at the beginning too, was that the society already has in place structures for dealing with problems when they come through. So we have a code of conduct regulating our behavior and our conduct and giving anyone out there, whether it's within the profession or the public, the means to complain and pursue a complaint against somebody in the profession or the profession generally. We have the Professional Matters Board dealing specifically with matters, the hard end of professionalism. And ultimately, you've got the disciplinary structures underpinning all that too. So where would our committee fit in? And I think that the way to think about it is that the work of this committee is to try and act in a way, interact with members, stimulate thought, get conversations going that would lead to conduct and behavior in the entities that we work for, and then us as individuals within there, that would stop anything ever getting to the other end, if I can put it that way. So this isn't about, and I might say that's a bit of a misnomer that we've come across in the discussions we've had. And in fact, before the very meeting today, somebody said, I've got some bones to pick with you. I've been unfairly treated. That's not what we're about. We want to hear that, but the remit of our committee is then to try and think, how could we stop that happening again? Not how will we deal with an offender or something going wrong at the moment. That's the other structures would deal with that. So that's really the remit of the committee and how we see ourselves positioned out there. Why would that matter to us? I think it's quite clear, and if you haven't, well, you all know that already, I'm sure. But within the companies that we work for, I mean, we wield a huge amount of weight and power and authority as a profession and have huge influence over the issues that drive market conduct issues. So if you think about it, I mean, it's just an endless list, but some examples there of where, whether you're directly involved or not in, for example, design or pricing or marketing of a product, very, very often it's members of the profession through positions either as sort of on the more junior level actually doing the work around that, or on a more senior level as management or senior executives overseeing this conduct. We tend to know what's going on. and we tend to have a lot of influence over what is going on. And I think that's really the point of this, that we have to take the responsibility and the power that we wield very, very seriously, because when we get into the case studies, we might see that a lot of things, when they do go wrong, could perhaps be traced back to either conduct or perhaps a lack of input or a lack of influence, or perhaps people battling to reconcile, people within the profession battling to reconcile the apparent conflict between their professional body responsibilities, the duty they owe to the profession, and the obligations they owe to their employer. And I think this is a perpetual debate and something that a lot of us grapple with all the time. But if you've got power and influence, you have to wield it appropriately. And Winthrop Williams Aldrich, if you ever get a moment, look him up. Interesting character. He was an American banker and financier who operated sort of in the first half of the last century and slightly into the second half. And he, a very wealthy man and very well connected with all the right people. And it's interesting to think that a banker, an American banker, would have said something like that. Because if he had lived a little bit longer and seen the havoc and the devastation that was wreaked by the banking profession on the world at a later stage, then he would have been horrified, I hope, if he meant what he said here. If you look him up on Wikipedia, there's a lovely photograph of him in 1957 when he was already in his 70s, but he's talking to Marilyn Monroe, the beautiful actress. And all I can say is he's not staring into her eyes in that photograph. So he had a strong moral compass, it would seem, but he was a human as well. Anyhow, that's an aside. So having said that, that's really the background to the committee. That's where we come from. That's what we do. Before we get into case studies, can I stop at that moment and say, are there any questions, observations, comments? Hopefully no rants that anybody might have.
Neil, your very definition says market conduct relates to the entity relating to pricing, etc. What sort of power have you got? Well, let me put it like this. Should your committee not really look at the individuals who can influence the entity? So it's the market conduct. It should be the conduct of individuals, not the conduct of the entity. Is that right?
Yeah. So the definition of market conduct is a general definition. And at the end of the day, it is a product of the entity. It's the business, the insurance company, the asset manager, whatever, who is designing and selling the product. And that was the whole point. But why does it matter to the profession? Is because we as individuals work in those entities and can, in my opinion, hugely affect the way the entity's products present themselves in the market. Is that, yeah. Any other comments, questions? Okay, good. We're all still awake. Yeah. And no cell phones have gone off yet. You're very well behaved. With that, then, we're going to move on to our first case study, and we chose for this Credit Life. I'll just comment before we start that I've been involved in the society in many guises over quite a few years, and this is a hoary old chestnut that I think has been discussed many times within the profession. We have on our committee somebody who's very well versed on this, and that's Tamar. And she put together a really very well set out case study on Credit Life. So what I'm going to do is ask Tamar to come up and talk through the slides. And then at various stages, she's going to stop and ask some questions. And then Peter and I as the panel will get an opportunity to talk if needs be. But I hope that at the time when the questions come up, you know, we can get a good discussion going. And then I don't think in any of these there's a real answer, a right or wrong answer, but Tamar's been good enough to put together some thoughts on some possible answers. So I'm going to hand over to her now. Thanks.
Thanks, Neil. I should maybe just clarify that my expertness in this Credit Life question is I've actually only been working in this for about a year and 4 months now, but it did happen to be over the time when the national credit regulations had to be implemented. So I became a bit of a a new expert, I suppose. So I think, I mean, as Neil says, this is something that's been around for quite some time, and not just in South Africa. I think we all know the same PPI story that happened in the UK, and so it's probably something that we're all well aware of. I have to mention, because I think this is great, the first meeting that I attended, the market conduct, I think it's the second, third agenda item, is crocodiles. And I didn't know what a crocodile was, so I said, what is a crocodile? And Neil explained to me, well, crocodiles lurk just below the surface, and when you least expect it, they leap out and bite you. So I thought that was really cool. And this is a crocodile, I think, that, as Neil says, is lurking so long that we kind of forgot about it and just assumed it was a log. And the result we'll go through in a second. But I think that's maybe also just something to bear in mind, is that just because something's been a problem for a long time doesn't make it not a problem anymore. So the bad name that's been attached to credit life insurance and PPI, actually, is three main things. Was the overcharging, that it was found that, you know, premiums were probably too high for the cover that was given. The selling practices that Neil alluded to a little earlier, the fact that oftentimes people assume that in order to get the credit or this thing that they want, and often it was so, that they had no choice but to take this insurance product, that if they wanted, you know, the couch, then this thing had to go with it. And in many instances, what they found was benefits that couldn't even be claimed. Which obviously is problematic. You shouldn't have to pay for something that you would never, ever enjoy. So I think the result of this, because we left this crocodile log, was that legislation was then introduced. This was something that we saw in the press for a very long time as well. I think it was something that you could see that the regulators were getting very antsy about. And probably because nothing substantial seemed to happen, the result was legislation that was introduced. And I think that's a key learning in all of this, because I think the legislation itself is less than ideal. And I think we, as Neil said, are probably best placed to actually know what is going on in the industry and actually what is best for the consumer. And that is an awesome position of power. So the legislation that came out was effective 9th of August 2017, which is kind of a random date, also Women's Day, but I'm not sure there's any correlation. And basically what they did was they've prescribed certain minimum benefits if your credit life is compulsory. So if when you make credit available, you say, well, you have to have insurance to back this credit, then these regulations apply. So the regulations then prescribe what benefits have to be included, and it's an array of benefits. It's quite a comprehensive benefit suite. So it's life cover, it's disability, both temporary and permanent, and retrenchment benefits. They've also then put premium caps on these. So they've prescribed the amount that you can charge, for the maximum amount that you can charge for all of these benefits, and also put benefit design constraints, basically saying that if you are self-employed, then you can't be offered occupational disability. We can't charge for occupational disability, only this other disability that they've actually defined. And also, if you are retired, well, actually not if you're retired, if you're self-employed, you can't charge for retrenchment cover. They have also put in some policy substitution provisions, basically saying that the customer can select insurance from another provider, but that insurance then needs to comply with all of these regulations, because you as the credit provider made that credit life compulsory. And then the onus is actually on the credit provider to make sure that this substitute policy complies with these regulations. Ah, so here's the question that Neil was alluding to. So the first question is, what are the unintended consequences of this, or the possible negative outcomes to consumers?
Okay, so I think for me, if I can sit down, I'm supposed to be on a panel. I'm greatly skeptical about regulation in any way, shape, or form, because my observation is that regulation usually leads to the opposite outcome of what it's trying to achieve. It often does. So just an example there in what Tamar had up, the idea that there was a cap on the premiums. Now, it seems to me that if you're limited in what you can charge, then if there's any element of risk in credit life, the cost of which would be in excess of the maximum cap, then I'm guessing that what you would do is just not sell cover to those people because the risk would just be, too great for the premium that you could collect. So a well-intentioned piece of, and I'm sure legislation is all well-intentioned, but something trying to make things fairer for the customer and make the customer outcomes better, I think something like a premium cap to me is potentially a problem because you might then exclude people from cover, from even being offered cover, who otherwise would have liked cover and would have enjoyed cover. So that's one example of where I think an unintended consequence could come along.
Another unintended consequence, because you've imposed minimum sort of benefits that you have to have for a credit policy, in some cases it's pushed up the cost of getting a loan. In the past, maybe if you just had life cover, then the cost would be a lot lower. Now you've imposed these additional benefits, and so it's pushed up the cost of borrowing for and in a lot of cases for people at the low end of the market. So it's prejudiced them. So again, it's another unintended consequence. I don't think they intended to impact that section of the market, but that's what happened. People have ended up being forced to have benefits which probably they couldn't afford. And that's another unintended consequence.
Thank you. Oh, is it on? So I think some of the things that we've seen is that firstly, some of the banks have actually removed what would have previously required compulsory cover, and now those products don't require cover at all. And in some situations, people obviously do need a cover. So there's also been a lot of instances in the media where I think it was an Nedbank had taken away someone's house because the loan holder had died. So there's obviously a lot of situations where cover is compulsory, and now in particular on mortgages, some of the compulsory cover has now been removed. So that's an unintended consequence. And then with regard to what you said about imposing the cap and then the risk is higher than that, there's then also a situation where you don't want to say to people that we can't, because you can't differentiate the customers. So you can't say that, well, if you're under this age, we are willing to offer you credit life insurance, but if you're over this age, you're not. So then the people, then you obviously introduce some kind of cross subsidy and make it unaffordable for some other people.
Yep, you've got to be careful. I think this is a very gray area, and what's interesting, everyone has an opinion on this, so please don't crucify me on this. I think what I'll first start with the positive. I think before it was regulated, credit life was almost incomparable between providers. Everyone had a little twist and tail. So the one plus that you have is it's commoditized. So from a phase point of view, giving advice in terms of substitution, that entire risk is eliminated for the selling party. So I think it creates opportunity for mass production, and it's about scale. So it's able to produce a commoditized product to a customer at massive scale and efficiency, which I think was not there before. The downside to that is automatically competition is removed. So as soon as you commoditize it, the ability to compete on something else is taken away. You only compete on service. So I found that the biggest losers in this, and maybe that was intentional, is the bespoke offerings. So you want to do it in a rural area, custom homemade language, not via the web. That entire service offering is gone, not because they don't want to offer it, but the expense component that they can afford at that low-end scale makes it unaffordable just by virtue of the premium cap. And as I say, you have different views on it. Maybe that's exactly the intention. I'm sure that there are some consumers that wanted that. The point is that part of the market is out. But I think there's, with most things in life, a plus and a minus. My observation is unless you operate at scale it is impossible to recoup your expense component on lower end loans. That's the reality of it.
Yeah, actually, I think that's exactly it. I think there's definitely been some positives from it. I mean, there were some ridiculous practices happening, and I have no relation to the Lewises who were doing terribly bad things with their furniture company. not me. But yes, so I think there definitely have been some positives from it. I think it was something that had to happen because, as you say, it's also part of the market that is the lower end of the market and probably needs more protection than any other. I think just to kind of go through some of the stuff that we saw, which I think we've already addressed now, is, as you say, one of the consequences, which is positive, is no more overpricing, hopefully. So the fact that cover may not be made available, and some consumer groups may actually be worse off. And the reason for that is in that self-employed space where they've now defined so clearly that disability definition, a lot of credit providers before were actually quite comfortable offering disability cover to self-employed people. And they could certainly claim for it. We offered occupational disability to self-employed people, but now the way that is written, you actually can't offer occupational disability. That's probably the best match to the need, though, is if someone can no longer work, that's actually when they're going to start defaulting on their credit and need that cover to come in. So I think that's maybe what happens when sort of external people start putting in benefit definitions. And then the fact that you can still offer retrenchment benefits to pensioners is odd. I think as Neil said, some of the fact that Peter said, the fact that you have to now have comprehensive benefits, it may not actually suit everyone. It might be that now the loan plus insurance becomes unaffordable to them. And as you correctly said, I think some people are just not offering insurance at all. Not making it compulsory. And therefore, people are losing their houses. And I think it's even not just on home loans. Obviously, that's a big risk because that asset is huge. But even on some of the smaller things, you know, it's, if some families, if now suddenly they've got to cover a 10,000 rand loan when someone dies, it can actually leave them destitute.
I would imagine in the instance where they're not forcing people to take a cover, that the bank would then somehow price for the fact that debt's not collateralized. So presumably the cost of the borrowing would then go up. That just seems to make sense. So again, it's an unintended consequence that people are now paying more for borrowing because there's no, you know, if the person dies, the bank's not guaranteed to recoup their capital.
Yeah, absolutely. It introduces an additional default risk. Yeah. Okay, there's going to be more questions. So I think, guess that the other question is, what are the red flags and learnings from this? So what are the things that actually showed the thing was a crocodile and not a log?
I mean, for me, the obvious one is two really. I mean, when a product just gets bad press, the way Credit Life was getting bad press, there's something wrong. I mean, it was repeated and it was ongoing. The second thing is, I know from sitting on various bodies in the society over the years, this is not something that we didn't know about. This was much spoken of and I think has been raised as a crocodile in many other committees and other settings as well. To me, one of the, a question from this really is, what could or should the profession have done differently? And if faced with a similar situation again, would we act differently? Or would we just sit back and assume it's a log, not a crocodile, and then end up with consumers being subjected to legislation, which seems to be, you know, far from the perfect answer there. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think that's what we as a profession should be putting our minds to.
That's Arthur Else again. Neil and I served on council years ago. And this is one of the issues raised then at that time, the price of credit life. The problem was that some of the very senior actuaries were in fact the CEOs of insurance companies, and the motive is profit. when profit comes in, it's very difficult for the actuary to say, well, our price is too high, we need to reduce it. And so we've known about this 20 years already. So I think it's very difficult for an actuary to tell the managing director or the chairman of the board, we're making too much money when there's a market and people are buying the product. I think that was one of the problems. You don't really have, we've got influence, but we don't have power to fight the capital market system. So it's a real problem for us as actuaries. And I think had not been for the legislation, I think we would have probably still carried on, even with your committee. I don't know as much your committee could do to fight the capital system.
Yeah, it's a sobering thought. There must be something, though.
I think I've also been listening to the conversation over the years, and we very early on identified all three of the contributing factors to credit life being what it is. And our interventions should have been to suggest removing some of those before we got to the limit being implemented.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, simple rules like Canada have just one provider providing credit life in a certain relationship. So JD Group having only one provider themselves on that panel, introducing the competition rules, we could have contributed to that and suggested the regulations. So I think we were a bit powerless in actually saying this regulation is needed.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. And I think also the point about informing the customer, I mean, even if they just knew what else was available, and if we made it clear in the marketing material, maybe said what this thing does, what it doesn't do, I think you're right. Even without necessarily forcing our bosses to cut profits, which, I mean, it's difficult. there were probably some things that we could do.
Neil, let me throw a spanner in the works.
Oh, damn it.
A very, very contentious issue at the moment are asset managers' fees. You look at some of the managers taking 2%, 3%. The fees are vulgarly exorbitant. They really are. And that's a real issue. And the senior actuaries in asset consulting firms, drawing salaries, paying out big bonuses, and it's been questioned. And if you read in the paper, the coronation's bonuses recently have been questioned by Theo, I forget his surname, Theo? Buerta, Theo Buerta. There's a real crocodile. And when you get a pension fund and you realize that a 1% increase, 1% fee reduces the end benefit by something like 20%. And we as actuaries are sitting back saying, look at this. That is a real crocodile. It's like credit life. It's going to come back and bite, and there will be legislation. So I'd like your committee to look into it. And what can we do? We need our actuaries to say, listen, a fee of whatever, 0.5% or 1% is reasonable, draw bonus of 10 million and not 100 million. But there's a real crook. And that picks up the point. We know about it. We've known about it. Yet we don't really have power to, hopefully your committee does. But that is a real issue that's discussed at trustee meetings affecting real people, real pensioners.
Yeah, so I think, to a certain extent, we might not have power, but I think there are many instances where we do have power, but yet we choose, you know, the road of inertia. So again, from my field, if we look at healthcare, the health market inquiry has been ongoing for the better part of 2 years, and we've got hospital groups slinging mud at medical aids and medical aids slinging mud at professionals and so on and so forth, yet the society has not presented one presentation at any of the of the opportunities that they've had to make representations to the health market inquiry. So again, I think just echoing what Wim was saying, if your committee could look into something similar from a health perspective, because I mean, we do run the risk, you know, if we don't act. I mean, we love to sit back and complain and say that because of all this regulation, look at the spot of bother we find ourselves in, yet we don't do anything. Right? We've got a health market committee. I don't know whether they have done anything, but certainly from what I've seen, it's been absent. at best.
Cool.
So maybe I can just comment on the management issue. I think it's also another example of where everybody charges the same way. It's standard throughout the market for asset managers to charge percentage of assets. And so everyone's doing it that way, and everyone's charging whatever, 50 basis points, 60 basis points. So we're fine. And then, there's nobody coming up with new ideas and say, well, let's do it this way, and it's going to add value to the consumers.
I'd like to build on that. I mean, over the years with the credit life issue, and as Arthur says, yes, I mean, it goes back a long way. And even predating that, I was on another committee where this kept coming up. And, you know, my argument was always, well, what about competition? I mean, where is the effect of competition, which is kind of what you're saying? I mean, where is the someone breaking from the pack and offering credit life on much more reasonable terms, you know, cheaper, whatever, better for the customer, which you would have thought would then have an entry into the market and maybe, lead to the benefit of competition, which is better terms, better conditions. It's staggering to sit and watch year after year that just doesn't happen. I mean, I'm not going to say there's something sinister going on. I mean, collusion or anti-competitive practices, but one wonders. I mean, and maybe if the terms are set, the asset management fee thing is maybe another example. Maybe there's a complacency and a comfort that everybody gets into, comfort zone, with the amount of money they're making. Where's the effect of competition coming through? So I hear the requests for the committee to look into these things and see what we can do. I mean, as I said in the introductory slides there, what this committee can do is our aim or our goal is to encourage intervention and action up front. In other words, before the problem hits the need for regulation or, Lord forbid, anybody's ever accused of unprofessional conduct, or anything comes through the disciplinary structures, or the profession just gets a bad name because you're always standing around near the scene of the accident, or if you want to call it that, but never actually doing anything. And I think one of the things that the committee's been working on is trying to formulate the substance of what would be an APN, an actuarial practice note, just talking to the profession about the responsibilities and duties. But I do think that the comfortable days of all nodding our heads and saying, well, we know about these things and we know something should happen and whatever, but we're always waiting for someone else to do it. Mm-hmm. I think with the change in the oversight structure and just the way the wind is blowing in the world as far as regulation and accountability, if we don't act, I think there can be great problems for the profession down the track. So we've got to just try and keep working on everybody to do the right thing ahead of time, not wait for the problem, sit and watch it, and then maybe wait, you know, then at the end, who knows how badly things could go if the regulators really start getting involved. Any other comments on that? Any more views?
I think also just one observation on that is that like both these examples, I think it's almost that it's a second order effects your point about competition. So you want the bank loan, or you want the couch, we want the fridge, and then the credit life is after that. So you're not actually shopping for credit life insurance. And I think that's maybe where there's possibly a bigger risk, where we've got to be a bit more vigilant. Because I think maybe their competition isn't working as strongly as it should. Similarly, maybe with the investor, I mean, you look at, so who's performing the best? So it's Coronation, or it's Allan Gray, or it's Investec, whatever. You put your money with them. You know that everyone's charging fees. So, well, there's the fees. It's almost also a second order. You don't actually go and look for who's got the cheapest fees. And maybe those are the things that we need to just also acknowledge are the bigger risks, where market is not necessarily perfect. Not that any market's perfect. But South Africa's is the most perfect. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to do that.
Attack on capitalism.
South Africa's is the most perfect.
So Sorry, you got to talk into a mic the whole time. But Neil, what are you really saying? Your committee can't do anything? You're powerless? Because in the asset management industry, there are a whole lot of managers, but the intention is not to bring down fees. The intention is for the smaller manager to get where the bigger manager is and make all the money as well. So it's a perverse incentive. So I think anyway, it's going to be kept. And people are being affected. I mean, pensioners, every single pension is getting less because an asset manager is taking a big chunk. But what are you really saying? Are you saying your committee can't do anything? We just got to sit back like it was with Credit Life?
Okay, no, a good question and a philosophical one that's taxed us already as a committee. So we have discussed the issue of what we can do, but not as a committee per se, as a profession. Well, what can the profession do? We have a belief that we cannot, as a profession, through, say, the practice area committees, interfere with could a practice area committee impose pricing constraints on entities or in businesses in the industry? We believe the answer to that is no, that the practice area committees cannot do that. So there is, in that sense, we are powerless. We can't actually go making laws as a profession as to what, because at the end of the day, the actuary is using judgment, the actuaries are certifying financial soundness and all that sort of thing. And it's not for the practice area committees or us to impose that. I think this is the only power we have, Arthur, is to bring these issues out. You've got the Professional Matters Board, which will deal with issues that are taken to it. You'll have the disciplinary structure, code of conduct issues, and so on. Where is the conversation taking place within the profession and challenging people to take actions that they can take using the power and the influence? And I'm not sure I agree that actuaries have no power in the businesses they work in. I think they have huge power and huge influence in the businesses they work in as a rule. And, you know, that maybe there are exceptions out there. Will this lead to anything? Can we be successful? I would hope so. I would hope that that's maybe a puritanical hope. But I really would hope that by the profession having these discussions, maybe we can see something coming through. I think it would be the intention also to have sessions at the convention when you've got a much bigger audience and a broader representation from within the profession, and start challenging people directly on these issues and using, for example, case studies. We've got one later. If we get time, we'll see whether we've got time to get through them all. But we have got a shocking example of a benefit projection case study to show you, which actuaries simply must have been involved in. And to start bringing that sort of thing out, and I mean, I don't know if we get into naming and shaming. Hopefully we don't do that. But it is really to put the profession on the spot through these kind of discussions. But as for power that we have to actually go and make things different, no, I think that's we don't believe we've got those powers.
The one thing as well is, I mean, we were discussing one of the meetings, I think it was about portfolio selection. Sorry, I'm going completely off the topic. And the way that happens when people choose funds, you know, is that actually, does it work? Are we doing anything remotely right? And we did kind of get to the point in the meeting that, well, we can only deal with things that actually, firstly, affect where actuaries are involved. So that was kind of step one. We can't really start regulating financial advisors. So I think we have to also understand kind of, is it something that affects the actuarial, you know, is it something specific in the actuarial profession that actuaries specifically are involved with? And then, as Neil says, we can do what we can. So I think we've kind of, I think we actually touched on all of those things. I can go through these if you want me to. Should I go through them? Yeah. Okay, since they're here. So I think obviously some red flags are no one should ever be charged for something that they can't claim for. Consumers should be given options and information so that they can actually make the correct decisions. I think also that the premium charged is not excessive. So, I mean, interestingly enough, Credit Life is not always a bad deal. So I did a bit of a attested to see what credit life was like across the market. And I found that in some institutions, probably the bigger banks and whatnot, where they were charging rates, it's actually the cheapest non-underwritten cover that you can get. It's better deal than funeral benefits. It's a better deal than some of these other non-underwritten level life covers. So it's not rubbish, and it certainly serves a very good purpose. So I think it's also maybe the other learning is kind of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because it is an important product that serves an important need, and it can work very well. Customer complaints, that's always a good one. Should look out for those. Customer complaints at claim stage. If the claim ratios are really, really low, that's actually also one to look out for, because perhaps then people aren't claiming. Maybe they don't know they have the cover. Or, you know, I mean, that's definitely a red flag that someone should look out for. And, I mean, as Neil said, persistent bad press is always a good... That's probably quite down the line of the red flags that should have been looked at before. Oh, another question. Ah, well, we already know. Thanks, Arthur. Cool. I think that's the end of me.
Okay, thanks very much, Tamar. It's quite an interesting discussion there. And when you looked at me and said, credit life is not always a bad deal, I mean, I really believed you there. Because you had an earnest and highly convincing look in your voice. You should get a proposal form out now. I'll sign it at the end. Okay, thanks very much for that. We're going to move on now to then another one. We've got 35 minutes left. And I'm going to ask Peter to lead us through actuarial certification.
Okay, so the issue here is that in a number of cases, actuaries I think it's in a statutory role. So it's either on the life side where the statutory actuary certifies where the premium rates are financially sound, I think before the product can be sold, and also in the situation of a retirement fund evaluator certifies the financial soundness of a set of rules or the amendments to the rules. Now the way I understand it on the life side, I think it's a very narrow ambit. The statutory actuary is certifying whether those rules are financially sound. He or she doesn't have to look and ask the question, TCF questions. Is this product giving value for money? And I think it overlaps with the previous case study. In previous case study, I think statutory actuary would be well able to certify that a credit life product was financially sound, but and then stop there, but not have to think of the other issues. Is this product offering value? Are the claim rates very low? Is this product, you know, is it delivering value? Is it the right target market? So I think the statutory actuary could certify financial soundness, but not have to consider all these other issues. And similarly within the retirement fund space, when the valuator certifies that the set of rules or amendments are financially sound, then they're not required to ask the question, well, but is this rule fair? So we've got a couple of examples where, for instance, and again, to come back to the life side, where a product where there's excessive margins or very high assumed lapse rates. Now it could be that those lapse rates are correct. The product does have a very high lapse rate. So you do need to build it into your product. But it doesn't ask the question, for instance, a 50% lapse rate. I mean, are you really offering value for money if half of your people leave within the first year, and then you've got to pass those expenses onto the remaining people? And it's almost like a bit of a Ponzi scheme, it seems. So the other question was really, but in the retirement fund space, where the evaluator certifies that a rule change where all future surplus always goes to employer surplus account. Again,
that may be appropriate in some circumstances, but not necessarily always. So really, the question we're posing, and I think as you've probably seen from the previous case studies, there are no right answers to these. What we're hoping from these discussions of the case studies is to have a discussion to hear different sides. So the question that we're asking here is should other stakeholders be considered? Because I think to come back to the life example, there I think the stakeholder that was considered in the past is the life company. Is the life company gonna be able to continue if it sells its product? So we're really asking the question, should other stakeholders be considered?
Yeah, thanks. I'm not a life actuary, luckily, but I'll definitely venture opinion. Yeah. So I just off the cuff, I think actuaries are considering them. I think the problem they find themselves in is they have to dispose on a statutory obligation that's clear. It's a prudential requirement, and you must make sure that when you dispose that statutory responsibility that you do not endanger the future soundness of that entity, because in some way that'll be unfair to all the existing policyholders. But I'm pretty sure that those actuaries at reaching that level of education and responsibility are quite aware of the playoff where they might have to sign off on a premium rate that is quite expensive. I also do think that those actuaries often find that it's that expression of judgment is against the context of massive uncertainty. So if there was perfect data to eliminate all uncertainty, then the judgment call is easy. But I've seen so many times in other fields and even in the non-life where I play a lot that there's a lot of uncertainty, and often the margin is not just picked out of air to see if excessive profit could be made, but the uncertainty at the point of design or the point of entering the market is so severe that if you underpriced it, that you're endangering the other policyholders and you'd rather venture on the safe side. That line is different for everyone. The problem is not whether your line is right. The problem is, are you picking a line that balances it between everyone? Because even the other people in the organization, non-actuaries, have their own view on the line. And the biggest debates when they actually consider these things are not just with themselves, but with other stakeholders in the company. Because I was listening to the other conversations, the reality is the profession does not control the entire industry. We're just one part of this big chain. And often the success is not whether we are just expressing our view, but we're willing and able to convince others of our view in a sensible way or adjust our view to compensate for other views. So I think that is one of the challenges we have as a profession, is not dictating, but trying to explain the context of a decision, be open to challenge from all sides, and then jointly decide as part of an organization. I've just found for myself, just to take the responsibility if it's not all yours, is actually better to try and make that decision in a joint forum where there's more heads around than just deciding on your own. Yeah, that's my 10 cents.
Yeah, thank you for that feedback. Is there any other comments? Anybody want to
contribute to the debate? No actuary would charge only 10 cents for that volume of input and that amount of input. Well done.
It's like graded life.
No comment.
I'm Mike Walker. I want to talk about retirement funds. I think perhaps the question is being asked here because clearly actuaries have to certify that rule amendments are financially sound, and normally that's a very straightforward decision. But the question is more, should you be certifying whether rules are fair? And I have thought sometimes it would be quite nice to have the power to say whether they're fair or not. On defined contribution funds that exist at the moment, I think they're very simple, so it's not likely to be a problem. On defined benefit funds, of course, it's very different. The question about allocation of surplus. And I think there could be a case for defined benefit funds giving the actuaries the power to do that, to have a look at whether the rules are fair. And because it's not simply a question of when an amendment comes up, because when you actually look at the rules, you might look at all the rest of the rules and you discover there's lots of other rules there which are very old and just don't make sense or are inherently unfair. So often an actuary might say you should change this, but it would be quite nice to have the statutory power to say you need to change this. But I'm not so sure whether it's really necessary to go that far, because with there's a far less defined benefit funds around at the moment, so maybe it's not really worth doing. But I would comment that in a lot of older defined benefit funds, there were rules which I believe were completely unfair in the way the benefits were designed. And so it would be quite useful for actuaries to be able to pronounce on that. As to whether that's a good thing or not, you know, from a statutory point of view, I'm not sure.
Any further points? Anybody got any further points? leave your own mic.
I'd like to speak of Mike Walker's point. There are just two things I've learnt over the years. First one is, when I've certified rules, let's say all the surplus goes to the employer. We've got a fund that has that in its rules. It's a defined benefit fund. And the reason for saying that is things go wrong. The employer picks up the entire deficit. The members pay their 7%. So if things go right, why should the members share in the surplus? They get their guaranteed benefits. So I certainly think it is fair, but in the appropriate circumstances. But I've learned a lesson. I worked at one of the consultants, and they grant loans to the lower income people. And I couldn't believe it, 3% per month interest. Wow, these guys are ripping lower income people off. Until I got into a group and it was discussed. And the 3% interest covers the defaulting loans and the people who disappear. And that certainly opened my eyes to say, but hang on, before you criticize somebody, make sure you understand the rationale for it. So I think, and then a final point I want to make is that actuaries have a duty to the public interest. So I think that is in addition to the statutory duty. So if one sees something in a set of rules or premium rates that's against the public interest, you're obliged to bring that in as well.
Thanks, Arthur.
So maybe just one thing. So as part of our credit life work that we did internally, the question was asked to some of the actuaries, would you certify the fairness? And I must tell you, if you think there's two schools of thought on this, there's like 200 of them. But I think as a profession, yes, I'm very worried. Unless we canvas and clearly define what the signing or the certifying of fairness means, we are actually opening up the profession to massive, massive reputational risk. Because what I found in this, when you start to speak to the people at the coalface, what you might perceive as fair for the general rule can be proven to be unfair for one person. So I haven't seen some products that's fair to all. We might speak to it in a bland and a nebulous concept, but some components of simple cross-subsidy, which is fair in the aggregate, can be proven to be unfair to one person. So I think the only way that fairness can be expressed is in a forum where there's more than one professional skill set around there and it's joint decision-making. I must tell you where I'm at, as I'm very, very fearful for actuarial professions having to certify fairness. Soundness in its own is got a specific concept, but fairness speaking to the underlying users with a vast array of differences, my sense is exposes us as a profession tremendously.
So I had a comment that was quite similar to that, but I'm sure many people know that the proposed guidance under the Insurance Act actually does require the head of the actuarial control function to express a view on the fairness of product. And I've heard many actuaries say that makes them very uncomfortable. And similar to what you just said now, that what you're opening yourself up to. So when you talk about justifying a margin in the face of uncertainty, we can have a sort of more quantitative discussion about where that comes from and why we think it's reasonable. When you're talking about fairness to people, everything obviously becomes a lot more subjective. And so to put someone in that position and then later have to come back to them and say, but you said it was fair, I think it's a very unfair position to put all of the actuaries in. And so shame your committee's leaving here with a lot of extra work, but that's probably something for this committee to consider. Is we need some kind of guidance of, if you are forced to be making those decisions, what are the types of things that should be being considered?
So really, response to what you're saying, so would you say it's easier to certify something as being unfair rather than saying something is fair? Is that often actuaries talk about, you know, saying something is not unreasonable? Is that so? So in a lot of cases, it's easier to see if something is clearly unfair But it's a lot, I think what you're saying is a lot harder to be able to say, well, this is fair. You know, there's a lot, you've pushed that bar much, much higher.
I think conventionally, actuaries have been concerned with matters of fairness and commenting on basis in particular, analysis of surplus and the like. Yet, if I look at the rigorous process we go through to qualify, we encourage to think about all stakeholders. I think in this era of increasing thought around governance and ethics and the like, it's important that if we spot other issues or flags, that these be raised. And consideration needs to be given to a section of the report where certain matters could be raised. So, for example, if one is concerned about, say, excessively high lapse rates or high asset management fees or other factors, I think these need to be raised. And in with the Market Conduct Committee playing a role of identifying potential or actual issues and raising these to council, I think that it would be highly responsible of us to raise these issues in reports, for example, so that you leave it to boards of trustees to consider further. Later on down the line, there could be a lower reputational risk. So, for example, if one thinks back to the paper written by Rob Rosconi and matters he raised, and that survived in the industry for decades, which later came back to bite. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Okay, so really the question, I think we've had a discussion already, and really it comes back to the TCF framework. So we're saying, does TCF or even the actual code of conduct, is the actuary constrained to think beyond just the matter of financial soundness, even if that's what the certifying law is? In other words, the mandate of the actuary is it a narrow mandate or is it more wider one? I think we've had a good discussion. I don't think we've come with any clear answers, which is what we expected. But we've had a good discussion, and we thank you for your inputs, and we value each comment that was made.
Oh, thanks for that, Peter. It's actually very interesting listening to the views, because I think in a way, like trying to formulate advice and giving positioning to these issues for the profession is going to be extremely challenging. But you know, just building on what Arthur said earlier, there are overriding responsibilities that fall upon us. So, for example, in the code of conduct, I think there is reference to the public good or the public interest. So, actually, should be acting in the public interest. So that's in the code of conduct, and a breach of the code of conduct, I think, is de facto unprofessional conduct, and you can have a complaint laid against you. Ditto things that are either law or para-law, like TCF, but will become law, and under the new regulatory framework of supervision in the country, we'll see overarching requirements towards things like treating customers fairly and so on. So I think the days of actuaries being able to think, well, I mean, Peter's point, I'm being asked to certify, is this financially sound? This is a yes or a no question. And if the answer is yes, it's sound, I will sign it. Forget that this will collect five times the amount of money that's needed to pay the claims. That is very sound. The life office will simply not go out of business at this. So the answer is yes, and I will sign that. But the point is, and I think this is where the guidance or the content of an APN has to start getting us talking about this, is that while you are considering that and making that signature, still the public interest is there, and still the TCF and all the regulations that are there, and the vast number of regulations that are coming, still they operate. So we cannot look in isolation at what we're doing. We have to find a way to to bring these all into consideration. And I'm not saying I know how to do that or it's an easy thing to do, but I'm sort of sensing that the leap that we have to make as a profession is to have all of these filters and awarenesses switched on in everything that we're doing. And that's going to create the biggest problem, because I think the employers that we work for, as we've said, I mean, they're not asking you, is it fair? They're asking, will it sell? And can we make money from it? And one topic that taxed us greatly and we didn't put it in today, but also came up last year. I gave a talk at the Young Members Convention down in Cape Town in June last year, trying to encourage the people coming into that. I think at that session, there were some newly qualified actuaries, but there were a lot of student actuaries, and there were people who were considering coming into the profession. So it was a very, broad audience. And they started raising issues. And the one that came up was the question of selling funeral cover to benefit grant recipients. So you've probably all come across that. So people out there getting a couple of hundred rand a month as a child grant or whatever. And then there's people running around with forms signing you up to buy funeral insurance as a debit against your grant. Now, these are people who've got no money to begin with, and let alone spending money on, I'm sure if there's a claim, it must be very worthwhile to have the benefit. So these young members were raising that issue with us, and we've grappled with that as well. And the bottom line is that there is somewhere in that process, there's pricing going on. There is certification of rates and products going on. And that must include distribution strategies, and that's part of the remit of market conduct. So I don't know what the answer is, but talking to the profession about their duties, and somehow independently of what whoever's paying you your wants to hear, we have our professional duties too. And how long is it before some sort of catastrophe befalls a profession? If you look at the speed and kind of aggression with which the auditing profession is currently under the cosh, I mean, not just here, but around the world. I mean, the scandals, I don't think there's any of the big accounting firms that are not embroiled in some or other scandal somewhere. And one's picking up that it's diminishing the stock of the auditing profession. I mean, I'm certainly coming across that. Lord forbid it happens to us, and it's up to us to take that action. Which leads on to nicely the last case, which hopefully won't take too long to go through, but it'll be interesting to get reaction from the floor on this. It's to do with benefit projections, and just, I mean, I suppose it would be more dramatic to build this up line by line as we go, but we haven't really got time for that, so let's go through. So this was a real example. We've got the thing that the insurance company produced, the bit of paper that they produced that was put in front of the policyholder. It's a five-year product. It was a savings product, an endowment. The premium in the first year is up there. Final year, that's with 10% escalations. So the total premium that the insurer would have expected to get if the policy had run properly to its course would have been 40,293 rand. In the event, something obviously happened along the road, and maybe the insured didn't feel like paying all the premiums or missed an increase or something, they collected 37,877. But the guaranteed maturity value at the outset, when the expected premiums are 40,000, the guaranteed maturity value was stated as 30,300. So, you don't need to be a genius to understand that keeping the money in a tin in the kitchen would have been a better option than putting the money into the policy. If that's that guarantee is worthless, clearly, because there's an easier way of matching that or even exceeding it. There was inflation projections for the policy value at maturity based on a low inflation scenario, which I think was 6% from memory, and the high inflation, which was 10%, I think. And the low inflation projection was 41,000, which you don't have to be too clever to see is a few hundred rand greater than what you were expected to put in. And again, you could probably have done much better than that. And even the high inflation projection of 46,300, okay, maybe there might have been some value if you could have achieved that. The actual maturity value that came out after 5 years, 36,465 rand. So, I mean, really a catastrophic failure, I think, in all sorts of ways, that this product could have been designed, let alone sold. And I'm sure there's many more examples like this out there. We've been looking for case studies and coming across stuff. And this is just an example of what goes on out there. There were costs of about 5,400 Rand. And at the outset of the policy, knowing what the total premiums that were going to be received were going to be, the 40,000, the higher figure, if the policy unfolds the way it should, still, the stated costs inherent in the policy were some 13.4% of those premiums. So there's a lot of ground to make up over 5 years in terms of returns to try and extinguish that. In terms of the actual premiums paid, it was 14.2% in the end. And the reduction in yield inherent in the projections that were given was 9.3% if inflation was the low range, which was okay, 4 to 6%, and 10% if inflation was at the higher level. So the impact of the fees on the product is very substantial. Now, that was all disclosed. That was all in the paperwork. It was all there in figures on the page. So the questions that arise here, you know, it's not, I mean, what chance did the policymaker have of ever getting back more than what they put in? And was there really a feasible chance that they would do well from this? And then a question that is very close, that, I mean, this worries me greatly. It comes back to the point that I was making earlier about regulation and the impact of regulation and how badly things can go wrong. You know, so if people are getting bad outcomes through policies, the regulators say, well, then let's give policyholders more information. So now you have to prepare more information. You have to, all the arguments about how projections will be done, how the figures will be presented, all the caveats that will go into that, all the new staff you have to get and the systems you have to put in to prepare all this stuff, and then it all goes out there. Does it actually help? Do disclosures actually help the people who are buying the products? Therefore, was the regulation worth it? It's a pity. I don't know if we've got anybody from the FSB here today. On our committee, we've got representation from the FSB. So we are something we're really trying to get our minds around. The answer isn't to tell people more information and give them more necessarily, unless it can present it in a way that will change behavior at the consumer end of the scale. But as Tamar said, when what you want is that fridge, it really doesn't matter what you tell them. They want the fridge, and they're going to sign anything and accept anything to get there. So do disclosures really help? Do they really alert the customer to what may happen? And so much of the regulation that we've got and is coming through and future regulation is all about more communication, more greater voluminous communication to people. I'm very skeptical whether it'll have the intended consequence. And then the acid test that I often throw on the table when people describe this stuff to me is, would you recommend such a product to your own mother? If she bought it to you and said, I've been offered this, should I buy it? What would your answer be? And if your answer is run a mile, this is a ripoff and we can get much better value in much simpler ways elsewhere. Then why do these products exist? Open to the floor. Okay. You're earning lots of 10 senses there. You're going to have a big check for you in the post at the end. Eh?
Yeah, no, I think it's a tough one there, Neil. So I guess context is always one thing that's missing. So I was, you know, tongue-in-cheek thinking maybe the underlying investments were related to an international furniture retailer. In that respect, it's actually spectacular returns. But, you know, the answers are quite simple. You know, maybe it's no and no and no. And the answer, I don't have the answer, but I also share your concern, not only for policyholders in terms of, you know, really reading the disclosures, but I think just as a society as a whole, everywhere actuaries are interfacing in the engines of the financial machine, there is massive complexity that's hitting us. Actuaries are making judgment calls on the go as they operate. They have to document them and then distill them to 30 or 40,000 feet of height and explain them to decision makers. And if something does go wrong, I still have said this before, especially on the non-life side where there's quite a big shift to the SAM regime, I'm quite worried that somewhere we only need to make one really proper mistake, accidental oversight, one mistake, and the professional will really feel the brunt of it because it's getting quite complex. So I also think that regulation is not necessarily the perfect silver bullet for all of it. In this example, in my view, simple. The policy had never had a chance. And if they just read the disclosures the way you said it, then, you know, you'd be quite silly to pay this, unless there's something else that we're not seeing, either a loan or there's a guarantee or they invested in heavy, you know, dubious securities and that was all known. But on the face value, you know, I also don't think these things should go out. I'm not sure if in the complexity of the machine that actuaries who want to do good always see that end product on a regular basis. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, you know, where do we think we need to go dig and ask and scrub around so that we rather change those in the companies before the media or someone else points it out to us?
Mm. Yeah. Which really is the question, is what could happen? What would the world look like in a world where the profession was doing something to prevent this? How and where would that be? Not sure I've ever met an actuary who said, I resigned from my employer because I disagreed fundamentally with what they were doing, or what they were asking me to do. Has anybody ever come across that? Arthur?
Yeah, Rob.
Rob's a good example. Sorry, yeah. Okay. Forgot about him. Okay, any other comments, or are we all... well done on that. I think the case is... Part of the advice I give young actuarial people coming into our business is to always have that person or entity or something sitting on your shoulder watching what you do when you're taking decisions and when you're doing your work. That's a little devil that sits there watching. That person can see it all, and that's your conscience. That is watching everything you do, and your conscience is always watching. So I think that's a sobering thought. I put that up at the Young Members Convention. There was a collective gasp from the people there. They didn't think necessarily yet about the fact that everything they did was going to be under such scrutiny. And then finally, that's really the necessity for the committee that we have. And I urge you all, please, to make whatever input you can, either in I think the easier end is sort of examples of things that you see that might be going wrong, where you think the profession should be thinking about that. And as I say, it's not dealing with the miscreants or dealing with the bad behavior at the other end. It's preventing it in the first place, and how we get the profession to change its stance in terms of the input and the influence that we can have all the way through. And then anything that any ideas that anybody has in terms of how that advice to the profession could be formulated and put out there, the content of an APN. What can we do? Because I think this is a very, very important conversation for us to be having, so we can avoid the catastrophe or the one case or whatever that goes wrong one day. And it would be awful if we as a profession, which I've always thought just contains the most amazing bunch of people. I remember very early in my career working in a company that had actuaries from the Faculty of Actuaries and the Institute of Actuaries, because they were separate back in those days, and then the Society of Actuaries of America, and then, in fact, one from Canada. So it was quite a place, you can imagine, a bit of a Tower of Babel. And I'd always been brought up to think early in my career in Scotland that the faculty was the best. And these institute guys, you know. Well, and then don't even mention across the water what's going on in North America. And what I learned, in fact, working with people, is it doesn't actually matter which professional body you've gone through. There's an incredibly high caliber of people. They really are marvelous. And everybody I worked with, they were of the highest caliber. And it just seems to me that the reputation and the name of all of these people, which is all of us here and all our colleagues out there, it's kind of on the line. And if we don't get this right, then we could find ourselves as a profession on the downward slope. And that would be a terribly sad state of affairs to reach. So please, anything you can bring to us, any ideas, any thoughts you've got, we really would welcome that. And then I think it just remains to say thank you again very much for coming along. There was an attendance register doing the rounds. Has everybody had an opportunity to sign that? Okay. There's three people out here who haven't seen it yet, so we need our CPD as well, you know. And then finally, just to thank Tamar and Peter for their input and efforts in putting this stuff together, and the other members of the committee. There was a meeting in Cape Town on Tuesday, a similar sessional meeting, which apparently went very well and was well attended as well. So thank you very much and look forward to further engagement. Thank you.